following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, everybody, you know what time it is. It is time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the greatest Tuesday you have all week. I am your host, Dave Littlejohn, and joining me today in studio is not Matt Dixon.
No, Justin Bruggeman.
And Justin, this could mean only one thing, right? No, it could mean several things, but what it probably means is Matt is off hunting somewhere.
Yes. Hopefully doing well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's a fictional trip.
Right? It might be.
He said, oh, I'm bow hunting for elk, and I'm like, so you're chasing unicorns.
Yes.
Because elk don't exist. We've been over on this program. You've tried to see them at like a preserve or something like that. Somebody sent you a picture. It's Photoshop.
Or you went to Elkton and saw them.
Yeah.
On the way to the coast.
Right. Which that's the only, it's a preserve, and those actually aren't elk. They are some kind of mutant reindeer. Okay. Right? So not elk. Just so we're clear that they're fooling you, elk don't exist. Anyway, glad we had that talk today. We're talking about things that do exist. We're going to talk about investment stuff today. We're going to talk about, this one. If I say this, do you think people will just, like, change the channel?
Maybe.
All right. Here's the deal. If you're wondering to yourself, hey, is now a great time to invest? We're going to really peel some layers back on this. And we're going to do it in a slightly unorthodox way. But Justin and I were talking about how can we do this. Now, first, let me tell you what we're not going to bore you with. The efficient market hypothesis.
Okay.
Which was my original idea.
Okay.
And Justin was like, go on. And I'm like, you know, it means these things. And he's like, yeah, that sounds riveting. So, but we did think about, here's my question. Justin. We'll start with a yes or no question. Justin's the chattiest member of our team, by the way. So, yes or no, is the S&P 500 expensive?
Yes.
Oh, how do you know?
Well, based on historical measures, I guess, would be.
Uh-huh.
And it just feels even expensive on top of that.
Right. And so, actually, what we're going to do is we're going to kind of help explain what makes people say this right now. And I want to encourage you to stick around. You may actually learn something that will. So, like, let's say if you're a do-it-yourselfer, hopefully you know this stuff, right? And if you don't, you should, okay? But let's say that you're working with a financial pro that's not us, right? Which is okay. We're not, we say this all the time. Just find somebody you can work with that you like and you trust. But they should be able to answer these questions too. They should be able to help you, and so this may help you to have better interactions with your advisor.
Right.
And maybe you just want to know about it, and we're going to be the ones to share it today. So, Justin, talk to me for a second about there are two big schools of thought for how to analyze investment markets. Do you know what I'm thinking of?
Fundamentals and technicals?
Yes, you do. Yes. You nailed it.
One for one.
Yes. So, explain to our listeners kind of what they are, just so we're all working from the same sheet of music here.
Well, the technical side would be kind of the charts, like what their price movement is compared to, you know, even historical data or even weekly data or daily.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fundamentals would be more kind of diving into the balance sheet of the companies and how much they're producing, their margins, their earnings. It can be a whole slew of different things. Fundamentals is more diving into the deep stuff.
Yeah, I like to show. So the technical is actually the really easy one. That's the good news.
Yeah.
Technical is study of price and volume. Meaning, hey, it's kind of like instead of studying about a company, you study the people that are buying and selling it.
Right.
And you figure, well, based on the behavior of lots of people, I can sort of ascertain what people think. Okay. Now, in practice, it's not that straightforward. And there's a whole school of thought out there that says technical analysis is nonsense.
Right.
Okay? I actually don't think it's nonsense. I think in the short term, there are enough people. There's a certain concept called self-fulfilling prophecy. Right? If enough people are doing something, it starts to walk and talk like it's real.
Right.
Bitcoin. So that's funny to me, by the way. That's why it's because Bitcoin, I still can't figure out why the tokens in Bitcoin are valuable. I'm not sure what Bitcoin is doing other than, well, it's this blockchain. Okay.
Right.
And what's it securing? And it's like, well, itself. Okay. And so why is it valuable? It's like, well, because they're unique digital signatures for each token. I said, no, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what makes the token valuable? It's like, well, because people will pay money for it.
Right.
I go, but why? Because people believe it's worth something. Like, oh, okay. And then invariably, it's like, well, what about fiat currency, right?
Right.
So, okay, I get it. I mean, like, people would say the same thing about the dollar or this or that. Well, yeah, it was decentralized. Like, never mind. You know, I give you a whole bunch of reasons why I'm still like, I don't know. But it could just mean I'm just too old and I don't get it.
Well, I'm younger than you and I don't get it either. So,
but here's the neat thing. Fundamental data, separate from technical, right?
Right.
That's the stuff that you can kind of go measure.
Mm-hmm.
Most of it. Some of it is fairly objective data. How much is on the balance sheet?
Right.
You know, some of it is subjective. How high quality is the management team? You know,
okay.
Do they have a good board of directors? Right. You know, what's the trend in the marketplace? Well, some of it's art and some of it's science.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we would call fundamental data. Here's what's fun about it. The fun in fundamental. Maybe that's the show title. I'm looking at Blake for a second. Do we make that? We put the fun in fundamental? Dad jokes on air. So let's talk about how we measure the value of something with something really simple. And I'm going to just kind of warm us up with a really simple idea. One of the most famous, here, Justin, what do you think is probably the most commonly known piece of fundamental data about a company? Don't say its name. That doesn't count.
Well, I would say probably price to earnings.
Okay. We did not pre-rehearse this, by the way. That's how common it is. Like,
yeah.
You had like a 1 in a million chance, and you're like, well, I'm going to pick
Nailed
the biggest
it.
One. Can you walk our listeners through, it's sometimes called the P.E. ratio also. What is it?
Well, the price of the stock versus the earnings of the company.
Yeah.
And what people are willing to pay for it.
Yeah. So what you do is you take the number of shares that are being traded.
Mm-hmm.
You look at how much money the company generated in profits, and you divide the amount of profit by the number of shares.
Right.
And then you get a number, and then you compare the price of the per share, right, what somebody's trading for a share of the stock, to the earnings of each share of stock, right? So here's a really simple one. If you have a company that's 1 million shares outstanding, and it's $1 a share, and it makes 50 cents in earnings per share. Like, so it made $500,000 in profit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it makes 50 cents per share. The price to earnings ratio would be 0.5 over what, right? It'd be half.
Right.
It'd be a 1 or so, or a 2 is what we call it. So the price to earnings ratio is, well, I guess it'd be 50 cents on the dollar, right? That would be it. So, which is a 1/2 is the PE ratio. But we would just do that with any number. Okay, so if you look at a company that makes, you know, the share price $100 and it earns $1, you have a PE ratio of 1. If it's $100 and it earns $17, you have a PE ratio of 17, right? But that's largely what we're looking at is how much, here's another way to say it. How much do I have to invest to get $1 of earnings from that company?
Okay. I guess that's an easier way.
Right? I mean, if we think about
right.
it that way, because what does that tell us, too? If a company has a really low price-to-earnings ratio, what does it say?
The companies grow, I guess.
Well, yeah, you don't have to put that much money in to get some earnings out of it.
It doesn't have to do as much.
Yes. So why is this relevant? Well, it can give you a sense of how much a company is maybe worth by comparing it to how much it's earning and looking at other companies and seeing what people are willing to pay for other companies and how much they're earning.
Right. Okay. Comparing to its peers.
Yeah. Now, what do you think are some things that might make the price to earnings ratio less comparable but from one company to the next? Like, why can't we just compare every company out there on the basis of how much earnings do they make per share of stock? Like, what are a few things that could affect that analysis?
Size of the company.
Okay. So big company versus a small company.
Right.
Okay. What are some others that might affect it?
I guess would sector could probably be another.
Well, that's part of it too. Actually, you're hinting at one of those, right? Like peer group.
Mm-hmm.
Said, well, hey, let's not compare a utility company to a technology company.
Right.
Why do you think comparing utilities and technology companies is not necessarily an apples to apples to comparison?
I guess because utilities could be considered more value companies and not necessarily growth companies.
Ah, and it's the growth element at play here. Do you remember a few years ago when Tesla had a negative PE ratio?
Yes.
Okay, today they don't.
Right.
So what does that suggest? What happened that changed?
Well,
Tesla, they became profitable.
Yeah, they were profitable.
So they grew a bunch, right? So here's one of the reasons price to earnings ratio is not specifically an obvious indicator. What happens if one company is doubling every year and another company's been around for 100 years and it's growing at 3%? Right? Different growth rates.
Right.
People are willing to pay different amounts for the future growth of the company.
Right.
And so that's why a PE ratio is not necessarily the end all be all, but it's one of many. Okay. So now that you know this, let's think about for a second. Can we look at an index? And, you know, normally the PE ratio is something we apply to an individual company.
Right.
But I hear the story that we also can apply this to indexes. How does that happen?
I would imagine it's the weighted average of the PE ratio inside all the stocks that are inside that index.
Correct. Correct. So the S&P 500 is an example. You can take all of the companies and all of their shares and, you know, you can weight them all and all the earnings and say, well, great. Well, this is how much if I took one share of the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
So all 500 stocks, and then I took all the earnings from it and did the math. I could get a PE ratio. Now, today, do you know where that PE ratio is for the S&P 500?
I do, because I'm cheating, and I just looked.
Oh, go for it.
Just under 26.
Okay.
So 25.9.
Now, the question I asked earlier is that expensive?
Historically, yes.
Ah.
Compared to,
and I'm going to say, compared to, well, let's do this. I want to compare a bunch of stuff, but compared to right now, we got to take our first break. So why don't we do that? We'll grab our first break. When we come back, then we're going to kind of talk about some of these comparison numbers and what that means. All right. So anyway, we'll do that. And then, we got some other ratios, but we're going to say, how can you figure out something's expensive? Not. Well, let's figure it out together. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Justin Bruggeman.
And got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM. 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. I am your host, Dave Littlejohn, in studio with me today,
Justin Bruggeman.
And reminder, you can get caught up if you go to littlejohnfs.com and you can check out the podcast where this will be broadcast. Today, we are putting the fun in fundamentals. Yes. I like the way I could still get a little bit of a smile out of you. Fundamentals, for those of you, if you ever wonder, hey, how do I know if a stock or an investment is expensive or not? Well, it's hard to figure out sometimes. Mm-hmm. Right? Some people are really good at it, but it's very interesting because at different points in time, something may be expensive or not so expensive, right?
Okay.
Warren Buffett at Berkshire Hathaway, famous for buying things when he perceives them to be on sale.
Correct.
Oftentimes, folks believe that he is crazy, and oftentimes the market does go against him in the short term, and people will still say he's crazy, and yet over decades, he has compounded at something north of 15 to 20% per year and has been an extraordinarily successful investor.
Yes, he has.
So Warren Buffett and the late Charlie Munger used to use what they called their multidisciplinary model, where they looked at all kinds of different ways to try to divine value for a company.
All right.
And we're talking a little bit about that. But if there's all these different disciplines, well, what are some that we could use, right? And the first one we talked about was the very simple, down the fairways, typical price-to-earnings ratio.
Right.
But we talked about how that sometimes can be misleading, right? Because the price-to-earnings ratio may be different from one sector to another. And a lot of the reason for that could be the rate of growth of a company.
Right.
That you're looking at a snapshot of what you're paying for earnings today, but investing is about what you're paying for earnings tomorrow. Okay? So there is a simple adaptation that's also available that we call the forward PE. Okay?
Right.
Now, what does that sound like? Justin, what's the forward PE based on for our listeners, just so they can understand?
Expected future earnings?
That is what it is. Right? For everybody that's out there going, you're supposed to phrase it like a statement. You're sounding a All question right. like...
Expected future earnings.
There, nailed it. Good job. Yeah. So why would we use that?
To do projections.
Right.
On where we think the economy is headed.
Yeah. Okay. So then...
or that company.
How would that be different than the PE ratio?
Well, because it's past information versus future
Right.
information. So
where does the projection come from?
That.
Yeah. Someone's hat.
Yeah.
Right? Right. Someone has a pricing
Somebody
model.
Made it up.
CEO may come out and say right. on their earnings call, hey, this is what we're expecting for next quarter. Right? This is where the earnings estimates come from and the guidance that companies offer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's reflected in what we call a forward PE, which the number is typically lower than the current. Like typically you'd expect a forward PE to be lower than the current PE. Why would that be?
Just probably year over year, that growth probably isn't as consistent.
Well, it's a math question, right? You would expect if the company is growing,
mm-hmm.
then the future number ought to be, you're changing the numerator and the denominator in the equation, right?
Right.
So you're saying, well, based on today's price, if we see right. higher growth based on today's stock price, then we would expect the number to go down.
Correct.
And then we also would oftentimes see investors start to buy that number, like buy the stock at what they perceive to be a lower price. And then you'd start to see the future earnings become more aligned with the current PE ratio,
okay.
which would imply the stock would start to move up in value.
Right.
And remember, none of this is guarantees that this is how it works. Right. These are just different pricing models, okay? So that's one of the ways that the forward PE can be useful in trying to anticipate future value for a company,
mm-hmm.
okay? But we kind of know that things, like sometimes markets get hot and sometimes markets get cold,
right?
Right? So how might we, still using the PE ratio of a company, try to take some of the hot and cold out of the markets? What do you think is something we could do?
Well, smooth it out.
Okay.
Smooth out how, yeah. you know, over, say, a 10-year period instead of year over year.
So help me out here. Smooth out the PE ratio?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or the, you know, the average price versus the average earnings over a 10-year time frame.
Okay. So walk me through what that might kind of like... How you do that?
Go back 10 years and you take it through. I mean, I don't know. I guess it's a short answer.
Oh, sorry.
I just know that's what it sort of is.
Gotcha. There is actually a metric. Here's the good news. You don't have to do the math, right? It's all over the internet. People have done it for you. There's something called the cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio, or the CAPE ratio, sometimes called the Shiller.
Mm-hmm.
I believe Shiller was an economist that really favored this as an indicator. You know, the markets, they go up, they go down. It's kind of hard to get a sense of what direction it is. But if you look out over time, you can see the line generally goes up.
Right.
And so we're looking for a way to smooth out our indicators so that we don't have to deal with the upsy-downsies of day to day.
Right.
And that's kind of what it does. It says, well, let's take a moving average of the last 10 years of price-to-earnings ratios. And then we'll use that trend as an indication of where things are going, and we'll smooth out our indicator. And that will take some of the extreme edges of the hot and cold markets out of it. Now, here's what I think is really wild. When we look at the current S&P rate, the current PE ratio of the S&P, what did we say it was?
25.9.
Okay. How does that compare to historical averages?
It's usually between 15 and 20.
Okay, so that's
so it's
higher.
High. It's high.
Higher. That would suggest that we're paying more than typical for earnings.
Right.
Okay, the Shiller PE, right? The CAPE PE, the CAPE ratio here. What's the historical average of that 10-year rolling, you know, average of the PE ratio?
Well, since 1870, 16.9.
Okay, where is it today?
37.87.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now you can see why a lot of financial professionals are saying this market looks expensive.
Right.
Okay. What are some other metrics that we might use? Now, it's funny. We do this all the time, by the way. We do this with assets that you may be more familiar with. If any of you have ever bought a house and you got a mortgage, mm-hmm. what's one of the things that you had to do in order to prove to the bank or the credit union that they should loan money to you on the house?
Well, your credit report.
Yeah. But what do they do about the house?
They appraise it.
Yeah, an appraiser, yeah. Right? Send out a third party, and they look at it. And what does the appraiser do?
Values your home.
Yeah, and they compare it on a bunch of different metrics.
Right.
Right? Well, what if you rented it out? Here's the cash flow. Well, what if, how does it compare on a price per square foot basis? How does it compare on the total number of bedrooms versus bathrooms? What about the types of materials it's made out of? What year was it built, right? They look at all these different things and do comparisons. That's what we do in the markets too, right? That's what they do in the stock market. So there's some other metrics that we could look at. What are some other ways, some other fundamental value points that we ought to look at?
Price to book ratio.
Okay. So how would we do? What does that mean?
The price to the book ratio, David.
So imagine if I took a company and I was to look at all of the assets that it owned. Right. Let's say that we went to Apple and said, well, I need to know all the buildings that you own, all the equipment that you own, all the furniture, everything, patents, all that different stuff. And I'm not really going to I may try to value what we call blue sky. That's sort of the brand appeal.
OK.
But if I was just looking at the company itself and said, well, if I liquidated everything, what would it be worth?
Right.
OK. And then I just divide that by the number of shares, and that gives me a sense of, well, here's the book value per share, just the asset value, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not really looking at the value of the cash flows and that kind of thing. I'm just looking at the value of the assets of the company.
Okay.
So what we don't really like to see is companies with really low book values, because it tends to sort of identify a company as under distress. If it's only worth what its liquidation value is, then you're like, well, the company maybe isn't running real well. But it also can mean that there's opportunities for investors, because maybe it's a turnaround story where the company could get healthy again and it could improve, start growing again. So it is a very useful thing to look at. But I think what's really fascinating is to look at the comparison of the price to book ratio today versus what its historical average is again. So
it's more than double the long term.
Yeah, what's like, because historical average is what?
Just under 2%.
Okay, and today
or not 2%.
Mm-hmm.
And 4.68.
Okay. So it would suggest that the book value, it's trading at a higher ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's better on paper in terms of like the company's maybe theoretically healthier. But it's significantly higher than typical, which would again suggest that maybe it's expensive. Okay? Let's talk about, here's a really interesting one, because I think most of us can understand this too. I look at this and go, well, let me tell you what it is, and then we'll tell you why you care about it. Many of you have heard of dividends, okay? In simple terms, a dividend is when a company is sharing profits with shareholders.
Right.
Okay. So if you own Apple, Apple's profitable, Apple pays a dividend, then what it's saying is everybody that owns a shareholder, we're going to give you a profit share.
Right.
Okay. And you're going to receive that as income. Well, there are some things that we can learn about whether or not a company is paying out dividends and how much those dividends are compared to the stock price. You know what we can learn? I'll tell you. But as I look at this, we got to take our next break. All right. So when we come back, let's look at what can we learn from the dividends. We got a couple others, but the reality is I just want to show you, like, how can you do your own analysis? Is the market expensive or not? So we'll keep unpacking this stuff. Stick with me. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Justin Bregman.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where we're trying to understand today whether or not the S&P 500 as an index and, well, is it expensive? Why the S&P 500, Justin?
Because it's the 500 largest stocks in the United States.
Yeah, and it's probably the most commonly discussed index held in most government pensions and most 401ks. Right, this is probably the broadestly held index out there is the S&P 500. I can't assure that, but I mean, like, it's pretty much the standard. So we're trying to figure out, is it expensive? Right, how much does the S&P 500 cost? How much should it cost? And how would we assess, if we were trying to act like an appraiser, how would we assess the value?
Well, I mean, you'd probably start by looking at past value.
Yes.
And so, then it would tell us, yes, it is expensive compared to historical numbers, but the landscape has changed as well, too.
That's the interesting one. So, you know, I'm not going to ask you to predict the future here, but let's just, for our listeners' sake, rather than like just walking them through boring data point after boring data point, let's just have a quick conversation about, like, how might the S&P be fairly valued today, even though the metrics look off? Like, what might need to change so that we find ourselves going, oh, it turns out that was a heck of a deal?
What do you mean by that? Sorry.
What would it take for the markets to go significantly higher from here and for it not to feel irrational?
Acceptance of a new multiple? Or we're just growing at massive rates?
Yeah, I mean, if we had really high growth rates, then, because what did we see in the last segment, if you guys kind of missed it, remember, it's on the podcast, but we talked about how current PE ratios versus future PE ratios, the future value, if companies project higher earnings, then that we see a lower future PE ratio than current.
Right.
Right. And that lower is a reflection typically of anticipated growth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we could see a really high growth environment.
We could.
Right. So if we thought companies were going to get a lot bigger, then maybe the valuations are really not out of whack at all.
Right.
Okay. It's just a short-term snapshot, but you know, the companies, they're going to grow at 15%, and not 3. And then you go, oh, well, in that case, by all means, let's dump more money into this thing, because the way it goes, right? So that's the question you have to ask yourself, is do we see a bunch more future earnings that look more attractive than what we see today? By the way, this is
potential.
Yeah, I'm gonna ask you this question. We didn't really talk about this, Justin. I'm gonna throw this out there to just see kind of how you would work this in. When somebody talks about gold, okay, and people will say things like, "Well, what about gold? And should I buy that?" Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Gold's not a company, right? It's a placeholder. Right. So what is gold kind of? How does it go up in value? Well, why does it go up in value?
Because there's a finite supply of it, and you know, it's considered to be an inflation hedge.
Okay, so why is it an inflation hedge? I guess you said finite supply, but what kind of walk me through how that works? Walk me through the concept of when it's an inflation hedge because it's a finite amount, and so why would somebody buy gold if they think there's going to be inflation?
Because usually the price paces inflation, if not a little bit higher.
Yeah, it's kind of it's like a macroeconomic play. It's not a play on a company.
Right.
Right? If you're just like, I don't know, I just know that we're printing money.
Right.
And so I don't want to try to pick winners and losers. I'm just going to try to protect my purchasing power. Then gold might be a way to do that.
Yeah.
Right? So it's more like an economic decision when people are talking about gold. I think it's sold a lot of the time as fear.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it seems to.
Yeah, I mean, any time that I hear somebody go, well, you know, you need to get your IRA in gold or something, and I just go, whoa, whoa. Right? And I'm not trying to give investment advice on the show, per se.
Mm-hmm.
What I want to caution you is, like, gold doesn't produce something.
No.
Right? It just sort of hangs out, and it's hard to duplicate, and as a result, it tends to adjust to the new values in the marketplace. If we print a bunch of money, they can't print more gold.
Right.
So the gold just becomes worth more money. That's how it protects you from inflation. But if I'm looking at the economy and I have a choice between, well, do I put something in, you know, just buy gold because I expect inflation versus could I find a company that could be profitable in an inflationary environment? Right.
Right.
Like an example might be, okay, again, not a recommendation, but let's just play this mental experiment out. How might a utility company similarly protect me from inflation but not be a passive asset like gold or a commodity like gold?
Well, typically utility companies don't go, like, they don't charge less.
Right.
And people have to have it. I mean, you have to have power.
That's the key,
mm-hmm.
right? And so they keep existing because you don't get the luxury of not having power or water,
mm-hmm.
right? Those utilities are going to happen. And because you pretty much never see the prices roll back, right? Oh, we had an inflationary event. Well, we raised the prices.
Right.
I mean, around the Pacific Northwest where we live, everybody's really sensitive because a few years ago we had big forest fires
right.
and a bunch of houses were destroyed. And then, you know, the power companies paid big damages out because there was some negligence in that process that the court system ruled. And now the power companies have mm-hmm. to recoup that. So yep. what happens? Everybody's paying higher power.
Now
costs.
Everybody's paying for it.
Yeah. So in that respect, oh, well, houses got more expensive and so did your power bill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, investing in those utilities, in theory, would have been protecting you against that inflation.
Right.
But there are also businesses that could grow. They could expand their footprint. They could, you know, they could shrink too, but.
And they can go through lawsuits.
And they can go through lawsuits. But it's interesting because they are also government-protected monopolies.
Right.
So they don't typically go away.
Yeah, you don't usually have a choice from one company to another.
Which is why these are interesting conversations about, well, should I buy gold or should I buy utilities or should I buy this or should I buy that? Well, what economic environment is driving the markets? Okay, so anyway, that's just a little side note. I want to talk about another one that I think is pretty obvious, but maybe it's not. And that is dividends.
Okay.
When we talked about at the break what dividends are and how companies are paying profit shares to their investors.
Right.
How can we figure out the value of a company using the dividend as a price indicator?
As in the index or just?
Yeah, in general. Like how would you value a stock if you knew what, like let's say I didn't know anything about the company, but I knew how much of a dividend it was paying. How might I come up with a value for that stock?
Well, you would have what you bought it for and how much you expect to receive in yield or
yeah.
interest.
Yeah, this is something fun, by the way. You can Google this or throw it in ChatGPT or something and ask about it, called the dividend discount model.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so what you do is you say, okay, well, tell me what the risk-free rate of return is. So usually that's a 10-year treasury. So let's
right.
say the 10-year treasury is paying 4% and my dividend is 2%. Right?
Right.
And I'd say, okay, well, I could get 4% risk-free. I get 2% from this company that's paying me out a dividend. Then I have a decision to make as an investor. Should I just invest in treasuries and get 4%? Or should I invest in this company that gives me 2%? And my answer would be, I'd only invest in the company if I expected the growth rate
Correct.
Of the dividend plus the growth to exceed the 4%.
Right.
Right. So my risk-free rate is 4. So I need to make 4% plus the 2% plus, you know, a little something to take the risk.
Right.
So I kind of said that wrong. The 2% is part of the equation, right? But I need to get paid for taking the risk, and I need to at least make the risk-free rate of return plus
right.
the risk premium. So I could figure out a value by reverse engineering it to that number, right? And that's called a dividend discount model, right? So these are all different appraisal mechanisms.
So right? When you have, you know, the dividend yield, and let's just go off the S&P 500. Currently, it's 1.25%.
Yeah.
You know, historically, 4%.
Yes.
What do you think changes that causes that?
Well, again, the math is fairly straightforward because these are math problems. Like, right. We tend to look at this and go like, oh, is this a peculiar event in the marketplace? No, it's the way investors are treating stocks.
Right.
What's happening is investors are paying more for companies that are, they're paying more to get the dividend, right?
Okay.
I do think it's a little distorted, right? And I think it's distorted because within the S&P 500 in particular, we have a lot of growth companies that are paying almost no dividend, period.
Right.
And so you're mixing in companies that pay dividends with companies that pay no dividend. And so when you have the no dividend payers, it skews the average, right? Well, five of them pay and five of them don't, but the average is all 10 of them pay something, right? But in reality, that's not what's happening.
Right.
And we also know that the S&P 500 is not equally weighted.
Correct.
So not every position gets the same weighting in the index. So what I think is we're just seeing a bias towards fewer dividend payers in general in the index.
Right.
But because the growth stocks have performed so well, right? And we'll talk about that in a second. But the growth stocks have performed so well that they've kind of hidden the dividend stocks. And so we see this lower ratio. But if we were to strictly apply the math to it, we would suggest this: the index is overvalued based on the dividend that's being paid out for the index compared to historical norms. Right? I want to make that. But what we just laid out is, well, remember, high growth rates would skew those numbers. Okay?
Right.
And so I think that is something that's really interesting that I want to unpack. Before we do, let's talk about how this index has really changed. The last 20 years, we've seen some really significant changes. And there's two that I want to talk about. One of them is the way it's weighted by sector. The other is the way it's weighted by stock. Okay, let's talk about sectors first.
Okay.
Justin, we now have, I think, 11 sectors in the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
And several of them are pretty similar to what they've always been, you know, like consumer discretionary 20 years ago. Yeah, it's about 10% of the index today. It's about 10%.
Mm-hmm.
Utilities, about 3% 20 years ago. Today, about 3%. But there have also been some really interesting changes. Like the real estate sector wasn't even in there 20 years ago. Today, it's now there.
Right.
So now we've kind of put some. But what are some sectors that have really changed over the last 20 years? And when I say changed, like, not that the sector's different, but it used to be it used to be everything was about the same weighting in there.
Right.
Now they're really different.
Yeah, and this even kind of goes back to the yield change, the dividend yield changes, because energy typically is companies that they pay dividends.
Right.
And it used to be a 12% weighting in the S&P 500.
Okay, so 2005, 12% of the S&P 500 was energy companies.
Now it's 3.
Wow. 3%? So it's like the same as utilities now.
Right.
That's pretty wild.
And then financials was a big part, up to 20% of it 20 years ago.
Okay.
Now down to 13%.
You know, the wild one to me is the growth in technology.
Yes.
Which in 2005, tech was still booming,
mm-hmm.
right? And it had grown to 17% of the index about 20 years ago. Today, that has doubled since then. It's 34%. So more than a third now of the S&P 500 is in just the technology sector. And lest you think that that's not that much, consider also that communications, which the communications sector includes like Google and Facebook and some of those in there, that one has grown from 3% to 10%, right? So really you've got 10% in communications and 34% in tech.
Right.
44% is
You're
basically
almost
in tech
there.
Companies.
Yeah.
Almost half the index now.
And even there's tech wrapped up in the healthcare. There's financials anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think tech is kind of woven through everything in here now.
Mm-hmm.
But the companies themselves that are pushing the tech out there, yeah, that's pretty wild. So, but anyway, I just see that today's index doesn't look like the index of 20 years ago.
Right.
There is one elephant in the room that we really need to talk about, though, that I think is part of why all these numbers are skewed so much that it's hard to value them. You know what it is?
I'm going to guess.
Yeah, but you'll guess after we take our last break. Stick around. We're going to do that. And then when you come back, we will talk about the elephant in the room. Wildlife Safari will be excited. And so will you. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
I'm Justin Brugman.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with me today.
Justin Brugman.
And we're talking about how can one appraise the S&P 500. The good news is you don't have to do the work. There's like a million services that track all these numbers, and they throw them all over the internet. So much so that sometimes it's even tough to figure out what the heck to do with them, really. And what we talked about at the last segment was how today's index does not resemble the indexes that we have seen in the past.
Right.
It's the same index, right? It's still the S&P 500. It's still the 500 largest companies by market cap in the United States. But what we've seen recently is this sort of winner take all in the space, right? Justin, help our listeners for a second. Can you explain to them what a cap weighting is and how it works in the S&P 500?
Well, the larger the company, the larger the weight in the S&P 500. So if you're tracking the index, one company may represent 8 to 10% of it, depending on how large the company is.
Yeah. And cap rating is short for market capitalization, right? That's a fancy way of saying, what's the company worth based on what shareholders are paying for the stock?
Right.
So if one share of stock is $100 and there's a million shares outstanding, it's a $100 million company. The market cap is $100 million.
Right.
Okay. So what's going on in the S&P 500 is the index is cap weighted, meaning the bigger the company, the more real estate it gets.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what are the top, what's the biggest company now in the S&P 500?
Is it NVIDIA now?
It is NVIDIA. Okay.
That's amazing.
And it's interesting because 5 years ago, NVIDIA was not a name that a lot of people heard of.
No.
Okay. What does NVIDIA do, just so our listeners know?
Semiconductor company.
Semiconductors, right? They started in graphic processors. That was kind of their claim to fame initially, is they did graphic processors, and they were on board for a lot of laptops and other desktop computers. And they discovered the graphics cards were really useful for mining Bitcoin. And so they started selling like crazy during the Bitcoin craze back in 2017. So 2016 and 17, and people were making,
lots,
these crypto mining units.
Mm-hmm.
And then we pivoted and we saw that they happened to make really good chips for artificial intelligence processing. And so they started building server farms with AI processors. And they've just exploded. They have surpassed Microsoft and Apple. So Apple, at one point, the largest company in the world, backseat, with Microsoft being the largest company in the world by market cap, now both eclipsed by NVIDIA. So NVIDIA, 8.1%, Microsoft, 7.3%, Apple, 5.8%. But I want you to kind of do the quick math on that. Three companies represent more than 20% of the weighting in the S&P 500.
That's crazy.
Three companies. I'm going to read the list of the top 10, which represent 38% of the S&P 500. NVIDIA, this is in order from biggest to the smallest of the top 10. NVIDIA, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Google, which is known as Alphabet, on Meta or Facebook, Broadcom, Berkshire Hathaway, Tesla, and JP Morgan. Berkshire Hathaway is really the only company that's a holding company that's a consortium of multiple companies. So if you look at that top 10, that's 38% of the S&P 500 right now. What I'm telling you is if you were to put your finger on the scale, you can change the measurement. That is why a lot of the traditional metrics for valuing the S&P 500 are hard to discern right now.
Right.
Because you got 10 stocks that are almost half, like 38%. They're 12% from being half of the S&P. So 10 stocks, what about the other 490? And we shrug our shoulders and go, what about them?
Right.
The problem is, if something goes, if any of those 10 stocks has a bad day, you feel it more.
Right.
I think longer term, subject for a different show, the question is the S&P 500 still as diversified as we think it is? And the answer may be no, but that's a topic for another day. I think the topic for today that I'm going to leave us with is, Justin, if folks are trying to figure out how to navigate this for themselves, how can they reach us if they don't have somebody that can they can help from?
They can email us at info@littlejohnfs.com or call the office 541-375-0898.
That's it.
Or they could text that number as well.
Yep. And the key on all of this, gang, is, look, if you're doing it yourself, great. Keep doing it. Keep learning. If you're working with somebody else, that is okay. You know, we just want to make sure that you find somebody that you can get the help from. But if you don't have somebody, then by all means, give us a shout. It costs nothing to kick the tires, right? If you just want a second opinion or you want to continue down the path, see if we can help, give us a shout. But otherwise, I encourage you to keep learning on this stuff because it's really fascinating. And the market is, it's definitely different today than it's been really at any point in my career. You know, it's and I could tell you, I've seen a lot of trends. It's just interesting now. Anyway, speaking of trends, we're out of time on this one, so we better run. Till next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Justin Brugman.
And you've been listening to True Wealth. Thanks for tuning in.